This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, please visit LibriVox.org. Today's reading is by Ian Bartholomew. The Peloponnesian War by Thucydides, translated by Richard Crawley. Chapter 26. 21st year of the war, recall of Alcibiades to Samos, revolt of Euboea and downfall of the 400, battle of Cynossema. In the same summer, immediately after this, the Peloponnesians, having refused to fight with their fleet united, through not thinking themselves a match for the enemy, and being at a loss where to look for money for such a number of ships, especially as Tissaphernes proved so bad a paymaster, sent off Cleitus, son of Rampius, with 40 ships to Pharnabazus, agreeably to the original instructions from Peloponnese, Pharnabazus inviting them and being prepared to furnish pay, and Byzantium besides sending offers to revolt to them. These Peloponnesian ships accordingly put out to the open sea in order to escape the observation of the Athenians, and being overtaken by a storm, the majority with Cleitus got into Delos, and afterwards returned to Miletus, whence Cleitus proceeded by land to the Hellespont to take the command. 10, however, of their number, under the Megarean Helixus, made good their passage to the Hellespont, and effected the revolt of Byzantium. After this, the commanders at Samos were informed of it, and sent a squadron against them to guard the Hellespont, and an encounter took place before Byzantium between 8 vessels on either side. Meanwhile, the chiefs at Samos, and especially Thrasybulus, who from the moment that he had changed the government had remained firmly resolved to recall Alcibiades, at last, in an assembly, brought over the mass of the soldiery, and upon their voting for his recall and amnesty, sailed over to Tissaphernes and brought Alcibiades to Samos, being convinced that their only chance of salvation lay in his bringing over Tissaphernes from the Peloponnesians to themselves. An assembly was then held in which Alcibiades complained of and deplored his private misfortune in having been banished, and speaking at great length upon public affairs, highly incited their hopes for the future, and extravagantly magnified his own influence with Tissaphernes. His object in this was to make the oligarchical government at Athens afraid of him, to hasten the dissolution of the clubs, and to increase his credit with the army at Samos, and heighten their own confidence, and lastly, to prejudice the enemy as strongly as possible against Tissaphernes, and blast the hopes which they entertained. Alcibiades, accordingly, held out to the army such extravagant promises as the following: that Tissaphernes had solemnly assured him that if he could only trust the Athenians, they should never want for supplies while he had anything left, no, not even if he should have to coin his own silver couch, and that he would bring the Phoenician fleet, now at Aspendus, to the Athenians instead of the Peloponnesians, but that he could only trust the Athenians if Alcibiades were called to be his security for them. Upon hearing this, and much more besides, the Athenians at once elected him general together with the former ones, and put all their affairs in his hands. There was now not a man in the army who would have exchanged his present hopes of safety and vengeance upon the 400 for any consideration whatever, and after what they had been told, they were now inclined to disdain the enemy before them, and to sail at once for Piraeus. To the plan of sailing for Piraeus, leaving their more immediate enemies behind them, Alcibiades opposed the most positive refusal, in spite of the numbers that insisted upon it, saying now that he had been elected general, he would first sail to Tissaphernes and concert with him measures for carrying on the war. Accordingly, upon leaving this assembly, he immediately took his departure in order to have it thought that there was an entire confidence between them, and also wishing to increase his consideration with Tissaphernes, and to show that he had now been elected general, and was in a position to do him good or evil as he chose, thus managing to frighten the Athenians with Tissaphernes, and Tissaphernes with the Athenians. Meanwhile, the Peloponnesians at Miletus heard of the recall of Alcibiades, and, already distrustful of Tissaphernes, now became far more disgusted with her than ever. Indeed, after their refusal to go out and give battle to the Athenians when they appeared before Miletus, Tissaphernes had grown slacker than ever in his payments. And even before this, on account of Alcibiades, his unpopularity had been on the increase. Gathering together, just as before, the soldiers and some persons of consideration besides the soldiery began to reckon up how they had never yet received their pay in full, that what they did receive was small in quantity, and even that paid irregularly, and that unless they fought a decisive battle, or removed to some station where they could get supplies, the ship's crews would desert, and that it was all the fault of Astyochus, who humored Tissaphernes for his own private advantage. The army was engaged in these reflections when the following disturbance took place about the person of Astyochus. Most of the Syracusan and Tyrian sailors were free men, and these, the freest crews in the armament, were likewise the boldest in setting upon Astyochus and demanding their pay. The latter answered somewhat stiffly and threatened them, and when Dorius spoke out for his own sailors, even went so far as to lift his baton against him. Upon seeing which, the mass of men, in sailor fashion, rushed in a fury to strike Astyochus. He, however, saw them in time and fled for refuge to an altar, and they were thus parted without his being struck. Meanwhile, the fort built by Tissaphernes and Miletus was surprised and taken by the Milesians, and the garrison in it turned out, an act which met with the approval of the rest of the allies, and in particular of the Syracusans, but which found no favour with Lichas, who said, moreover, that the Milesians and the rest of the king's country ought to show a reasonable submission to Tissaphernes and to pay him court, until the war should be happily settled. The Milesians were angry with him for this and for other things of the kind, and upon his afterwards dying of sickness, would not allow him to be buried where the Lacedaemonians with the army desired. The discontent of the army with Astyochus and Tissaphernes had reached this pitch when Mindarus arrived from Lacedaemon to succeed Astyochus as admiral and assume the command. Astyochus now set sail for home, and Tissaphernes sent with him one of his confidants, Gaulites, a Carian, who spoke the two languages, to complain of the Milesians for the affair of the fort, and at the same time to defend himself against the Milesians, who were, as he was aware, on their way to Sparta chiefly to denounce his conduct, and had with them Hermocrates, who was to accuse Tissaphernes of joining with Alcibiades, to ruin the Peloponnesian cause, and playing a double game. Indeed, Hermocrates had always been at enmity with him about the pay not being restored in full, and eventually, when he was banished from Syracuse, and new commanders, Potamis, Myscon, Demarchus, had come out to Miletus to the ships of the Syracusans, Tissaphernes pressed harder than ever upon him in his exile, and among other charges against him, accused him of having once asked him for money, and then given himself out as his enemy because he failed to obtain it. While Astyochus and the Milesians and Hermocrates made sail for Lacedaemon, Alcibiades had now crossed back from Tissaphernes to Samos. After his return, the envoys of the 400 sent, as has been mentioned above, to pacify and explain matters to the forces at Samos, arrived from Delos, and an assembly was held in which they attempted to speak. The soldiers at first would not hear them, and cried out to put to death the subverters of the democracy, but at last, after some difficulty, calmed down and gave them a hearing. Upon this, the envoys proceeded to inform them that the recent change had been made to save the city, and not to ruin it or to deliver it over to the enemy, for they had already had an opportunity of doing this when he had invaded the country during their government, that all the 5,000 would have their proper share in the government, and that their hearers, relatives, had neither outrage, as Carius had slanderously reported, nor other ill-treatment to complain of, but were all in undisturbed enjoyment of their property, just as they had left them. Besides these, they made a number of other statements which had no better success with their angry auditors, and amid a host of different opinions, the one which found most favour was that of sailing to Piraeus. Now it was that Alcibiades for the first time did the state a service, and one of the most signal kind. For when the Athenians at Samos were bent upon sailing against their countrymen, in which case Ionia and the Hellespont would most certainly at once have passed into possession of the enemy, Alcibiades it was who prevented them. At that moment, when no other man would have been able to hold back the multitude, he put a stop to the intended expedition, and rebuked and turned aside the resentment felt, on personal grounds, against the envoys. He dismissed them with an answer from himself, to the effect that he did not object to the government of the 5,000, but insisted that the 400 should be deposed, and the council of 500 reinstated in power. Meanwhile, any retrenchments for economy, by which pay might be better found for the armament, met with his entire approval. Generally, he bade them hold out and show a bold face to the enemy, since if the city were saved, there was good hope that the two parties might some day be reconciled, whereas, if either were once destroyed, that at Samos or that at Athens, there would no longer be anyone to be reconciled to. Meanwhile, arrived envoys from the Argives, with offers of support to the Athenian commons at Samos. These were thanked by Alcibiades and dismissed with a request to come when called upon. The Argives were accompanied by the crew of the Pharsalus, whom we left placed in a troop ship by the 400 with orders to cruise round Euboea, and who, being employed to carry to Lacedaemon some Athenian envoys sent by the 400, Laspodius, Aristophon, and Melesias, as they sailed by Argos, laid hands upon the envoys, and delivering them over to the Argives as the chief subverters of democracy. Themselves, instead of returning to Athens, took the Argive envoys on board, and came to Samos in the galley which had been confided to them. The same summer, at the time that the return of Alcibiades, coupled with the general conduct of Tissaphernes, had carried to its height the discontent of the Peloponnesians, who no longer entertained any doubt of his having joined the Athenians, Tissaphernes, wishing, it would seem, to clear himself to them of these charges, prepared to go after the Phoenician fleet to Aspendus, and invited Lichas to go with him, saying that he would appoint Tamos as his lieutenant, to provide pay for the armament during his own absence. Accounts differ, and it is not easy to ascertain with what intention he went to Aspendus, and did not bring the fleet after all. That 147 Phoenician ships came as far as Aspendus is certain, but why they did not come on has been variously accounted for. Some think that he went away in pursuance of his plan of wasting the Peloponnesian resources, since at any rate Tamos, his lieutenant, far from being any better, proved a worse paymaster than himself. Others, that he brought the Phoenicians to Aspendus to exact money from them for their discharge, having never intended to employ them. Others again, that it was in view of the outcry against him at Lacedaemon, in order that it might be said that he was not in fault, but that the ships were really manned and that he had certainly gone to fetch them. To myself it seems only too evident that he did not bring up the fleet because he wished to wear out and paralyze the Hellenic forces, that is, to waste their strength by the time lost during his journey to Aspendus, and to keep them evenly balanced by not throwing his weight into either scale. Had he wished to finish the war, he could have done so, assuming, of course, that he made his appearance in a way which left no room for doubt, as by bringing up the fleet he would in all probability have been given the victory to the Lacedaemonians, whose navy, even as it was, faced the Athenians more as an equal than as an inferior. But what convicts him most clearly is the excuse which he put forward for not bringing the ships. He said that the number assembled was less than the king had ordered, but surely it would only have enhanced his credit if he spent little of the king's money and effected the same end at less cost. In any case, whatever was his intention, Tissaphernes went to Aspendus and saw the Phoenicians, and the Peloponnesians at his desire sent a Lacedaemonian called Philip with two galleys to fetch the fleet. Alcibiades, finding that Tissaphernes had gone to Aspendus, himself sailed thither with 13 ships, promising to do a great and certain service to the Athenians at Samos, as he would either bring the Phoenician fleet to the Athenians, or at all events prevent it joining the Peloponnesians. In all probability, he had long known that Tissaphernes never meant to bring the fleet at all, and wished to compromise him as much as possible in the eyes of the Peloponnesians, through his apparent friendship for himself and the Athenians, and thus in a manner to oblige him to join their side. While Alcibiades weighed anchor and sailed eastward straight for Pharsalus and Caunus, the envoys sent by the 400 to Samos arrived at Athens. Upon their delivering the message from Alcibiades, telling them to hold out and to show a firm front to the enemy, and saying that he had great hopes of reconciling them with the army and of overcoming the Peloponnesians, the majority of the members of the oligarchy, who were already discontented and only too much inclined to be quit of the business in any safe way that they could, were at once greatly strengthened in their resolve. These now banded together and strongly criticized the administration, their leaders being some of the principal generals and men in office under the oligarchy, such as Theramenes, son of Hargon, Aristocrates, son of Schelius, and others, who, although among the most prominent members of the government, being afraid, as they said, of the army at Samos, and most especially of Alcibiades, and also lest the envoys whom they had sent to Lacedaemon might do the state some harm without the authority of the people, without insisting on objections to the excessive concentration of power in a few hands, yet urged that the 5,000 must be shown to exist not merely in name, but in reality, and the constitution placed upon a fairer basis. But this was merely their political cry, most of them being driven by private ambition into the line of conduct so surely fatal to the oligarchies that arise out of democracies. For all at once pretend to be not only equals, but each the chief and master of his fellows, while under a democracy, a disappointed candidate accepts his defeat more easily, because he has not the humiliation of being beaten by his equals. But what most clearly encouraged the malcontents was the power of Alcibiades at Samos, and their own disbelief in the stability of the oligarchy, and it was now a race between them as to which should first become the leader of the commons. Meanwhile, the leaders and the members of the 400 most opposed to the democratic form of government, Phrynichus, who had had the quarrel with Alcibiades during his command at Samos, Aristarchus, the bitter and inveterate enemy of the commons, and Pisander and Antiphon, and others of the chiefs, who already as soon as they entered upon power, and again when the army at Samos seceded from them and declared for democracy, had sent envoys from their own body to Lacedaemon, and made every effort for peace, and had built the wall in Eetionia, now redoubled their exertions when their envoys returned from Samos, and they saw not only the people but their own most trusted associates turn against them. Alarmed at the state of things at Athens and as at Samos, they now sent off in haste Antiphon and Phrynichus and 10 others with injunctions to make peace with Lacedaemon upon any terms, no matter what, that should be at all tolerable. Meanwhile, they pushed on more actively than ever with the wall in Eetionia. Now, the meaning of this wall, according to Theramenes and his supporters, was not so much to keep out the army of Samos, in case of its trying to force its way into Piraeus, as to be able to let in, at pleasure, the fleet and army of the enemy. For Eetionia is a mole of Piraeus, close alongside of the entrance of the harbour, and was now fortified in connection with the wall already existing on the land side, so that a few men placed in it might be able to command the entrance. The old wall on the land side, and the new one now being built on the side of the sea, both ending in one of the two towers standing at the narrow mouth of the harbour. They also walled off the largest porch in Piraeus, which was in immediate connection with this wall, and kept it in their own hands, compelling all to unload there the corn that came into the harbour, and what they had in stock, and to take it out from thence when they sold it. These measures had long provoked the murmurs of Theramenes, and when the envoys returned from Lacedaemon without having effected any general pacification, he affirmed that this war was like to prove the ruin of the state. At this moment, 42 ships from Peloponnese, including some Sicliot and Italiot vessels from Locri and Tarentum, had been invited over by the Euboeans, and were already riding off Lars in Laconia, preparing for the voyage to Euboea, under the command of Agesandridas, son of Agesander, a Spartan. Theramenes now affirmed that this squadron was destined not so much to aid Euboea as the party fortifying Chionia, and that unless precautions were speedily taken, the city would be surprised and lost. This was no mere calumny, there being really some such plan entertained by the accused. Their first wish was to have the oligarchy without giving up the empire, failing this, to keep their ships and walls and be independent, while if this also were denied them, sooner than be the first victims of the restored democracy, they were resolved to call in the enemy and make peace, give up their walls and ships, and at all costs retain possession of the government if their lives were only assured to them. For this reason, they pushed forward the construction of their work with posterns and entrances and means of introducing the enemy, being eager to have it finished in time. Meanwhile, the murmurs against them were at first confined to a few persons and went on in secret, until Phrynichus, after his return from the embassy to Lacedaemon, was laid wait for and stabbed in full market by one of the Peripoli, falling down dead before he had gone far from the council chamber. The assassin escaped, but his accomplice, an Argive, was taken and put to the torture by the 400, without their being able to extract from him the name of his employer, or anything further than that he knew of many men who used to assemble at the house of the commander of the Peripoli, and at other houses. Here the matter was allowed to drop. This so emboldened Theramenes and Aristocrates, and the rest of their partisans in the 400 and out of doors, that they now resolved to act. For by this time the ships had sailed round from Lars, and anchoring at Epidaurus had overrun Aegina. And Theramenes asserted that, being bound for Euboea, they would never have sailed into Aegina and come back to anchor at Epidaurus, unless they had been invited to come to aid the designs of which he had always accused the government. Further inaction had therefore now become impossible. In the end, after a great many seditious harangues and suspicions, they set to work in real earnest. The heavy infantry in Piraeus, building the wall in Etonia, among whom was Aristocrates, a colonel, with his own tribe, laid hands upon Alexicles, a general under the oligarchy, and the devoted adherent of the cabal, and took him into a house and confined him there. In this they were assisted by one Hermon, commander of the Peripoli, in Muncia, and others, and above all had with them the great bulk of the heavy infantry. As soon as the news reached the 400, who happened to be sitting in the council chamber, all except the disaffected wished at once to go to the posts where the arms were, and menace Theramenes and his party. Theramenes defended himself, and said that he was ready immediately to go and help and rescue Alexicles, and taking with him one of the generals belonging to his party, went down to Piraeus, followed by Aristarchus and some young men of the cavalry. All was now panic and confusion. Those in the city imagined that Piraeus was already taken, and the prisoner put to death, while those in Piraeus expected every moment to be attacked by the party in the city. The older men, however, stopped the persons running up and down the town and making for the stands of arms. And Thucydides the Pharsalian, proxenus of the city, came forward and threw himself in the way of the rival factions, and appealed to them not to ruin the state, while the enemy was still at hand waiting for his opportunity, and so at length succeeded in quieting them, and in keeping their hands off each other. Meanwhile, Theramenes came down to Piraeus, being himself one of the generals, and raged and stormed against the heavy infantry, while Aristarchus and the adversaries of the people were angry in right earnest. Most of the heavy infantry, however, went on with the business without faltering, and asked Theramenes if he thought the wall had been constructed for any good purpose, and whether it would not be better that it should be pulled down. To this he answered that if they thought it best to pull it down, he for his part agreed with them. Upon this, the heavy infantry and a number of the people in Piraeus immediately got up onto the fortification and began to demolish it. Now their cry to the multitude was that all should join in the work who wished the 5,000 to govern instead of the 400. For instead of saying in so many words, "all who wish the commons to govern," they still disguised themselves under the name of the 5,000, being afraid that these might really exist, and that they might be speaking to one of their number and get into trouble through ignorance. Indeed, this was why the 400 neither wished the 5,000 to exist, nor to have it known that they did not exist, being of the opinion that to give themselves so many partners in empire would be downright democracy, while the mystery in question would make the people afraid of one another. The next day the 400, although alarmed, nevertheless assembled in the council chamber, while the heavy infantry in Piraeus, after having released their prisoner Alexicles and pulled down the fortification, went with their arms to the theatre of Dionysius, close to Mincia, and there held an assembly in which they decided to march into the city, and setting forth accordingly, halted in the Anacium. Here they were joined by some delegates from the 400, who reasoned with them one by one, and persuaded those whom they saw to be the most moderate to remain quiet themselves, and to keep in the rest, saying that they would make known the 5,000, and have the 400 chosen from them in rotation, as should be decided by the 5,000, and meanwhile entreated them not to ruin the state, or drive it into the arms of the enemy. After a great many had spoken, and had been spoken to, the whole body of heavy infantry became calmer than before, absorbed by their fears for the country at large, and now agreed to hold upon an appointed day an assembly in the theatre of Dionysius for the restoration of Concord. When the day came for the assembly in the theatre, and they were upon the point of assembling, news arrived that the 42 ships under Agesandrides were sailing from Megara along the coast of Salamis. The people to a man now thought that it was just what Theramenes and his party had so often said, that the ships were sailing to the fortification, and concluding that they had done well to demolish it. But though it may possibly have been by appointment that Agesandrides hovered about Epidaurus and the neighbourhood, he would also naturally be kept there by the hope of an opportunity arising out of the troubles in the town. In any case, the Athenians, on receipt of the news, immediately ran down in mass to Piraeus, seeing themselves threatened by the enemy, with a worse war than their war among themselves, not at a distance, but close to the harbour of Athens. Some went on board the ships already afloat, while others launched fresh vessels, or ran to defend the walls and the mouth of the harbour. Meanwhile, the Peloponnesian vessels sailed by, and rounding Sunium, anchored between Thoracus and Prasiae, and afterwards arrived at Oropus. The Athenians, with revolution in the city, and unwilling to lose a moment in going to the relief of their most important possession, for Euboea was everything to them now that they were shut out from Attica, were compelled to put to sea in haste, and with untrained crews, and sent Thermocharis with some vessels to Eritrea. These, upon their arrival, with the ships already in Euboea, made up a total of 36 vessels, and were immediately forced to engage. For Agesandridas, after his crews had dined, put out from Oropus, which is about 7 miles from Eritrea by sea, and the Athenians, seeing him sailing up, immediately began to man their vessels. The sailors, however, instead of being by their ships, as they supposed, were gone away to purchase provisions for their dinner in the houses in the outskirts of the town, the Eritreans having so arranged that there should be nothing on sale in the marketplace, in order that the Athenians might be a long time in manning their ships, and the enemy's attack, taking them by surprise, might be compelled to put to sea just as they were. A signal also raised in Eritrea to give them notice in Oropus when to put to sea. The Athenians, forced to put out so poorly prepared, engaged off the harbour of Eritrea, and after holding their own for some little while, notwithstanding, were at length put to flight and chased to the shore. Such of their number as took refuge in Eritrea, which they presumed to be friendly to them, found their fate in that city, being butchered by the inhabitants, while those who fled to the Athenian fort in the Eritrean territory, and the vessels which got to Chalcis, were saved. The Peloponnesians, after taking 22 Athenian ships, and killing or making prisoners of the crews, set up a trophy, and not long afterwards effected the revolt of the whole of Euboea, except Oreus, which was held by the Athenians themselves, and made a general settlement of the affairs of the island. When the news of what had happened in Euboea reached Athens, a panic ensued such as they had never known before. Neither disaster in Sicily, great as it seemed at the time, nor any other had ever so much alarmed them. The camp at Samos was in revolt. They had no more ships or men to man them. They were at discord among themselves, and might at any moment come to blows. And a disaster of this magnitude, coming on the top of all, by which they lost their fleet, and worst of all Euboea, which was of more value to them than Attica, could not occur without throwing them into the deepest despondency. Meanwhile, their greatest and most immediate trouble was the possibility that the enemy, emboldened by his victory, might make straight for them and sail against Piraeus, which they had no longer ships to defend, and every moment they expected him to arrive. This, with a little more courage, he might easily have done, in which case he would either have increased the dissensions of the city by his presence, or, if he had stayed to besiege it, have compelled the fleet from Ionia, although the enemy of the oligarchy, to come to the rescue of their country and of their relatives, and in the meantime would have become master of the Hellespont, Ionia, the islands, and of everything as far as Euboea, or, to speak roundly, of the whole Athenian empire. But here, as on so many other occasions, the Lacedaemonians proved the most convenient people in the world for the Athenians to be at war with. The wide difference between the two characters, the slowness and want of energy of the Lacedaemonians, as contrasted with the dash and enterprise of their opponents, proved of the greatest service, especially to a maritime empire like Athens. Indeed, this was shown by the Syracusans, who were most like the Athenians in character, and also most successful in combating them. Nevertheless, upon receipt of the news, the Athenians manned 20 ships and called immediately a first assembly in the Pnyx, where they had been used to meet formally, and deposed the 400 and voted to hand over the government to the 5,000, of which body all who furnished a suit of armour were to be members, decreeing also that no one should receive pay for the discharge of any office, or if they did, should be held accursed. Many other assemblies were held afterwards, in which lawmakers were elected, and all other measures taken to form a constitution. It was during the first period of this constitution that the Athenians appear to have enjoyed the best government that they ever did, at least in my time. For the fusion of the high and the low was effected with judgment, and this was what first enabled the state to raise up her head after her manifold disasters. They also voted for the recall of Alcibiades and of other exiles, and sent to him and to the camp at Samos, and urged them to devote themselves vigorously to the war. Upon this revolution taking place, the party of Pisander and Alexicles and the chiefs of the oligarchs immediately withdrew to Decelea, with the single exception of Aristarchus, one of the generals, who hastily took some of the most barbarian of the archers and marched to Enoe. This was a fort of the Athenians upon the Boeotian border, at that moment besieged by the Corinthians, irritated by the loss of a party returning from Decelea, who had been cut off by the garrison. The Corinthians had volunteered for this service, and had called upon the Boeotians to assist them. After communicating with them, Aristarchus deceived the garrison in Enoe by telling them that their countrymen of the city had compounded with the Lacedaemonians, and that one of the terms of the capitulation was that they must surrender the place to the Boeotians. The garrison believed him, as he was general, and besides knew nothing of what had occurred owing to the siege, and so evacuated the fort under truce. In this way the Boeotians gained possession of Enoe, and the troubles at Athens ended. To return to the Peloponnesians and Miletus, no pay was forthcoming from any of the agents deputed by Tissaphernes for that purpose upon his departure for Aspendus. Neither the Phoenician fleet nor Tissaphernes showed any signs of appearing, and Philip, who had been sent with him, and another Spartan, Hippocrates, who was at Pharsalus, wrote word to Mindarus, the admiral, that the ships were not coming at all, and that they were being grossly abused by the Tissaphernes. Meanwhile, Pharnabazus was inviting them to come, and making every effort to get the fleet, and, like the Tissaphernes, to cause a revolt of the cities in his government, still subject to Athens, founding great hopes on his success. Until at length, at about the period of the summer, which we have now reached, Mindarus yielded to his importunities, and with great order, and at the moment's notice, in order to elude the enemy at Samos, weighed anchor with 73 ships from Miletus, and set sail for the Hellespont. Thither 16 vessels had already preceded him in the same summer, and had overrun part of the Chersonese. Being caught in a storm, Mindarus was compelled to run to Icarus, and after being detained 5 or 6 days there by the stress of weather, arrived at Chios. Meanwhile, Thrasyllus had heard of his having put out from Miletus, and immediately set sail with 55 ships from Samos, in haste to arrive before him in the Hellespont. But learning that he was at Chios, and expecting that he would stay there, he posted scouts in Lesbos and on the continent opposite, to prevent the fleet moving without his knowing it. And he himself coasted along to Methymna, and gave orders to prepare meal and other necessities, in order to attack them from Lesbos, in the event of their remaining for any length of time at Chios. Meanwhile, he resolved to sail against Eresus, a town in Lesbos, which had revolted, and, if he could, to take it, for some of the principal Methymnian exiles had carried over about 50 heavy infantry, their sworn associates, from Cuma, and hiring others from the continent, so as to make up 300 in all, chose Anaxander, a Theban, to command them, on account of the community of blood existing between the Thebans and the Lesbians, and first attacked Methymna. Balked in this attempt by the advance of the Athenian guards from Mytilene, and repulsed a second time in a battle outside the city, they then crossed the mountain and effected the revolt of Eresus. Thrasyllus accordingly determined to go there with all his ships and to attack the place. Meanwhile, Thrasyllus had preceded him thither with 5 ships from Samos, as soon as he heard that the exiles had crossed over, and coming too late to save Eresus, went on and anchored before the town. Here they were joined also by 2 vessels on their way home from the Hellespont, and by the ships of the Methymnians, making a grand total of 67 vessels, and the forces on board now made ready with engines and every other means available to do their utmost to storm Eresus. In the meantime, Mindarus and the Peloponnesian fleet at Chios, after taking provisions for 2 days,
and receiving 3 Kian pieces of money for each man from the Kians, and on the third day put out in haste from the island, in order to avoid falling in with the ships at Eresus. They did not make for the open sea, but keeping Lesbos on their left, sailed for the continent. After touching at the port of Carteria in the Phocaeid, and dining, they went on along the Cumian coast, and supped at Arganusa, on the continent, over against Mytilene. From thence, they continued their voyage along the coast, although it was late in the night, and arriving at Harmatus, on the continent opposite Methymna, dined there, and swiftly passing Leptum, Larissa, Hermaxitus, and the neighboring towns, arrived a little before midnight at Rhoeteum. Here they were now in the Hellespont. Some of the ships also put in at Sigeum, and at other places in the neighborhood. Meanwhile, the warnings of the fire signals and the sudden increase in the number of fires on the enemy's shore informed the 18 Athenian ships at Sestos of the approach of the Peloponnesian fleet. At very night, they set sail in haste, just as they were, and hugging the shore of the Chersonese, coasted along Elaeus in order to sail out into the open sea away from the fleets of the enemy. After passing unobserved the 16 ships at Abydos, which had nevertheless been warned by their approaching friends to be on the alert to prevent their sailing out, at dawn they sighted the fleets of Mindarus, which immediately gave chase. All had not time to get away. The greater number, however, escaped to Imbros and Lemnos, while 4 of the hindmost were overtaken off Elaeus. One of these was stranded opposite the temple of Protesilaus and taken with its crew. 2 others without their crews, the 4th was abandoned on the shore of Imbros and burned by the enemy. After this, the Peloponnesians were joined by the squadron from Abydos, which made up their fleet to a grand total of 86 vessels. They spent the day in unsuccessfully besieging Elaeus, and then sailed back to Abydos. Meanwhile, the Athenians, deceived by their scouts, and never dreaming of the enemy's fleet getting by undetected, were tranquilly besieging Eresus. As soon as they heard the news, they instantly abandoned Eresus, and made with all speed for the Hellespont, and after taking 2 of the Peloponnesian ships, which had been carried out too far into the open sea in the ardor of the pursuit, and now fell in their way, the next day dropped anchor at Elaeus, and, bringing back the ships they had taken refuge at Imbros, during 5 days, prepared for the coming engagement. After this, they engaged them the following way. The Athenians formed in column and sailed close along shore to Sestos, upon perceiving which the Peloponnesians put out from Abydos to meet them. Realizing that a battle was now imminent, both combatants extended their flank. The Athenians along the Chersonese from Indacus to Ariani with 76 ships, the Peloponnesians from Abydos to Dardanus with 86. The Peloponnesian right wing was occupied by the Syracusans, their left by Mindarus in person with the best sailors in the navy. The Athenian left by Thrasyllus, their right by Thrasybulus, the other commanders being in different parts of the fleet. The Peloponnesians hastened to engage first, and outflanking with their left, the Athenian right sought to cut them off, if possible, from sailing out of the straits, and to drive their centre upon the shore, which was not far off. The Athenians, perceiving their intentions, extended their own wing and outsailed them, while their left had by this time passed the point of Sinesina. This, however, obliged them to thin and weaken their centre, especially as they now had fewer ships than the enemy, and as the coast round Point Sinesina formed a sharp angle, which prevented their seeing what was going on the other side of it. The Peloponnesians now attacked their centre and drove ashore the ships of the Athenians, and disembarked to follow up their victory. No help could be given to the centre, either by the squadron of Thrasybulus on the right, on account of the number of ships attacking him, or by that of Thrasyllus on the left, for whom the point of Sinesina hid what was going on. and who was also hindered by his Syracusan and other opponents, whose numbers were fully equal to his own. At length, however, the Peloponnesians, in the confidence of victory, began to scatter in pursuit of the ships of the enemy, and allowed a considerable part of their fleet to get into disorder. On seeing this, the squadron of Thrasybulus discontinued their lateral movement, and facing about, attacked and routed the ships opposed to them, and next fell roughly upon the scattered vessels of the victorious Peloponnesian division, and put most of them to flight without a blow. The Syracusans also had by this time given way before the squadron of Thrasybulus, and now openly took to flight upon seeing the flight of their comrades. The rout was now complete. Most of the Peloponnesians fled for refuge first to the river Midius and afterwards to Abydos. Only a few ships were taken by the Athenians, as owing to the narrowness of the Hellespont, the enemy had not far to go to be in safety. Nevertheless, nothing could have been more opportune for them than this victory. Up to this time, they had feared the Peloponnesian fleet, owing to a number of petty losses and to the disaster in Sicily. But they now ceased to mistrust themselves, or any longer to think their enemies good for anything at sea. Meanwhile, they took from the enemy 8 Chian vessels, 5 Corinthian, 2 Ambraciot, 2 Boeotian, 1 Leucadian, Lacedaemonian, Syracusian, and Pellenian, losing 15 of their own. After setting up a trophy upon Point Cynossema, securing the wrecks, and restoring to the enemy his dead under truce, they sent off a galley to Athens with the news of their victory. The arrival of this vessel, with its unhoped-for good news, after the recent disasters of Euboea, and in the revolution at Athens, gave fresh courage to the Athenians, and caused them to believe that if they put their shoulders to the wheel, their cause might yet prevail.
On the fourth day after the sea fight, the Athenians and Sestos, having hastily refitted their ships, sailed against Cyzicus, which had revolted. Off Harpagium and Priapus, they sighted at anchor the 8 vessels from Byzantium, and sailed up, and routing the troops on shore, took the ships, and went on and recovered the town of Cyzicus, which was unfortified, and levied money from the citizens. In the meantime, the Peloponnesians sailed from Abydos to Elaeus, and recovered such of their captured galleys as were still uninjured, the rest having been burned by the Elaesians, and sent Hippocrates and Epicles to Euboea to fetch the squadron from that island. About the same time, Alcibiades returned with his 13 ships from Caunus and Pharsalus up to Samos, bringing word that he had prevented the Phoenician fleet from joining the Peloponnesians, and had made Tissaphernes more friendly to the Athenians than before. Alcibiades now manned 9 more ships, and levied large sums of money from the Halicarnassans, and fortified Kos. After doing this, and placing a governor in Kos, he sailed back to Samos, autumn being now at hand. Meanwhile, Tissaphernes, upon hearing that the Peloponnesian fleet had sailed from Miletus to the Hellespont, set off again back from Aspendus and made all sail for Ionia. While the Peloponnesians were in the Hellespont, the Antandrians, a people of Aeolic extraction, conveyed by land across Mount Ida some heavy infantry from Abydos, and introduced them into the town, having been ill-treated by Arsaces, the Persian lieutenant of Tissaphernes. This same Arsaces had, upon pretense of a secret quarrel, invited the chief men of the Delians to undertake military service. These were Delians who had settled at Aramantium, after having been driven from their homes by the Athenians for the sake of purifying Delos, and after drawing them out from their town as his friends and allies had laid wait for them at the dinner, and surrounded them and caused them to be shot down by his soldiers. This deed made the Antandrians fear that he might some day do them some mischief, and as he also laid upon them burdens too heavy for them to bear, they expelled his garrison from their citadel. Tissaphernes, upon hearing this act of the Peloponnesians in addition to what had occurred at Miletus and Cnidus, where his garrisons had also been expelled, now saw that the breach between them was serious, and fearing further injury from them, and being also vexed to think that Pharnabazus should receive them, and in less time, and at less cost perhaps, succeed better against Athens than he had done, determined to rejoin them in the Hellespont, in order to complain of the events at Antandros, and excuse himself as best he could in the matter of the Phoenician fleet, and of the other charges against him. Accordingly, he went first to Ephesus, and offered sacrifice to Artemis. When the winter after the summer is over, the 25th year of this war will be completed.
So ends the reading of chapter 26 of Thucydides' History of the Peloponnesian War. The reading was by Ian Bartholomew and was completed in Taipei, May 31, 2006.